So we're going to be in Acts chapter 10 tonight, and it's kind of a lengthy scene, so we'll probably be in it for a couple weeks as we go through this. A very important chapter of Acts chapter 10, and we'll see that starting tonight. But let me read for us Acts chapter 10, starting in verse 1 and going down through verse 23. That's what the scene we'll look at tonight. And so verses 1 through 23. So follow along as I read that. So at Caesarea, there was a man named Cornelius, a centurion of what was known as the Italian cohort, a devout man who feared God with all his household, gave alms generously to the people, prayed continually to God. And about the ninth hour of the day, he saw clearly in a vision an angel of God come in and say to him, Cornelius. And he stared at him in terror and said, What is it, Lord? And he said to him, Your prayers and your alms have ascended as a memorial before God. And now send men to Joppa, bring one Simon who is called Peter. He is lodging with one Simon, a tanner, whose house is by the sea. When the angel who spoke to him had departed, he called two of his servants and a devout soldier from among those who attended him. And having related everything to them, he sent them to Joppa. The next day, as they were on their journey and approaching the city, Peter went up on the housetop about the sixth hour to pray. And he became hungry and wanted something to eat. But while they were preparing it, he fell into a trance and saw the heavens open and something like a great sheet descending, being let down by its four corners upon the earth. And in it were all kinds of animals and reptiles and birds of the air. And there came a voice to him, Rise, Peter, kill and eat. But Peter said, By no means, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean. And the voice came to him again a second time. What God has made clean, do not call common or profane. This happened three times, and the thing was taken up at once to heaven. Now while Peter was inwardly perplexed as to what the vision that he had seen might mean, behold, the men who were sent by Cornelius, having made inquiry for Simon's house, stood at the gate and called out to ask whether Simon, who was called Peter, was lodging there. And while Peter was pondering the vision, the Spirit said to him, Behold, three men are looking for you. Rise and go down and accompany them without hesitation, for I have sent them. And Peter went down to the men and said, I am the one you are looking for. What is the reason for your coming? And they said, Cornelius, a centurion, an upright and God-fearing man who was well spoken of by the whole Jewish nation, was directed by a holy angel to send for you to come to his house and to hear what you have to say. So he invited them in to be his guests. And so that's where we'll kind of stop tonight, and then we'll pick up the scene later on. But just kind of a quick review, a little bit, because it's been a couple weeks as we've been going through the book of Acts here so far. And again, back in chapter 9, we see that it starts with Saul's kind of conversion, and then Luke, the second half, starting in verse 32, Luke brings Peter kind of back into focus, and he has these two scenes that lead up to what's happening here with Cornelius. And so, in Acts chapter 9, we see the apostles there in Jerusalem, and as then Peter goes, he goes up to the town of Lydda. And Lydda is about 25 miles or so away from Jerusalem. So as he goes up to the city of Lydda, he finds this paralyzed man, right? Verses chapter 8, verses 32 through 35. He finds this paralyzed man, and what does Peter do to this paralyzed man? He tells him to get up. He gets healed. And what happens as Peter heals this guy, what happens at the end of that with the residents in Lydda? They turn to the Lord. They hear these events of how Peter, what happened. Again, Peter's not doing these miracles in his own name. He says, no, Jesus Christ heals you. And as the news spreads throughout this area about how Jesus heals this guy, people turn to the Lord. People turn to Jesus. And again, that is We've seen so far over and over again in the book of Acts that as these miracles are being done, it's for the advancement of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so then Peter is there, and as he's there in Lydda, a lady in another town of Joppa dies. And what is that lady's name? Does anybody know? Tabitha or Dorcas. And if Tabitha is the Aramaic name, and Dorcas is her, if you want to say, her Greek name. So that's kind of why you have the two names. And as we saw a couple weeks ago, that means gazelle. So I know sometimes we use dork as another name in English, but that was actually a good name back in the first century of Dorcas. So, but she is there in the city of Joppa, and she dies. She passes away, and the disciples in Joppa hear that Peter is in Lydda. They go and get Peter, and Peter comes to Joppa. Now, from Lydda, there Joppa is right along the sea. We were talking about how Joppa was an important port city. This is a modern-day picture of Joppa. The town is still there, except for it doesn't go by Joppa now. It goes by Jaffa, kind of like the Jaffa Shrine in Altoona. That's the name of the city is Joppa. Still a very important industrial city. Shipping is still big into that area. And again, I always find it fascinating. This is kind of the old section of town. And you always think about, you know, some of those places have been around since the first century that people are still living in, which is kind of, I find that fascinating. In America, our homes, a lot of times, the historical homes, you know, they're dating back to like the 1600s, 15, maybe 1700s. In Europe, and especially in the Middle East, they're dating back to like the first century, second century, a lot older of a area back there. So, but Joppa is there. So Peter shows up at Joppa. What does Peter do in Joppa? He goes to the house where Tabitha's at, and he tells her to get up, and she rises from the dead. And again, what happens as people hear about what happened to Tabitha there? They started believing, verse 42, and it became known throughout all Joppa, and many believed upon the Lord. And so that's kind of leading up to where we find this next scene, as Peter is there still in Joppa, and he stays there for a few days, and he is living with what guy? Simon the tanner. Now again, if you look at this area where Joppa is at, it's kind of up in Samaria. So, which is interesting when you think about this, is initially in the book of Acts, we have seen the gospel starting to spread, right? Spreading amongst the Jewish people, spreading a few chapters ago, it's starting to spread amongst the Samaritans. And chapter 10 is that kind of a transition chapter. It's a very important chapter, not only for Peter and what happens throughout chapter 10, but also for the entire book of Acts is this transition chapter. Because up to this point in time, we have seen the gospel spread amongst the Jewish people. We've seen the gospel spread amongst the Samaritans. We've seen the gospel, at least one guy who was a Gentile. But up to this point in time, the gospel has mainly been all Jewish people responding and a few Samaritans that are starting to respond. Chapter 10, and actually the rest of the book of Acts, deals with how the gospel is going to spread amongst the Gentiles. But God takes the apostles on a journey to help them understand that this gospel just isn't for Jewish people, it just isn't for Samaritans, but is also for Gentiles. Why do you think God had to help the apostles come to this realization? Well, they are Jewish, and what was the mentality Jewish people towards Gentiles? They didn't like them. In fact, The mentality was that again, this is how the Jewish people understood themselves, that we are children of God, we are the chosen people of God, everybody else is inferior to us. In fact, the only reason why God made the nations or the Gentiles was to be fodder or fuel for the flames of hell. That was literally what the Jewish historians, like Josephus and so forth, that is what they teach. And that was the mentality. Yep.
Are they still the chosen people?
Galatians answers that. We'll get to that tonight. They are still have a plan and a role in how God is working. But in the New Testament time, the people of God are whom? Believers in Jesus Christ. And it doesn't matter if you're a Jew or a Gentile. A believer in Jesus Christ is understood as they are the people of God. So there's a little bit of a change with that. Galatians, the book of Galatians, it helps us understand that with understanding about how by faith a person is made right with God, not through works of the law. It has always been that way from Abraham all the way up through now. It has always been by faith. And whoever has that faith and trust in God, like Abraham had, is our sons of Abraham. And the reason why Paul talks about sons and not daughters is because of the first century culture. You wanted to be a son. You did not want to be a daughter, and because of inheritance. So when Paul talks about that in Galatians, about how we all are sons of Abraham, including women are sons of Abraham, which is interesting, not physically, but spiritually, is understanding that it doesn't matter who you are, male, female, slave, free, every single person comes to know is right with God the same way and has an inheritance of eternal life. So that's some of Galatians is where Paul deals a lot with this. So, which makes sense because the book of Galatians is written after Acts chapter 15. We'll get there eventually, but everybody know what happens in Acts chapter 15? Flip to Acts chapter 15. Anybody have a heading on Acts chapter 15? The Jerusalem Council. And so what were they debating about in Acts chapter 15? Does anybody know? Circumcision. Does a Gentile person have to become a Jewish person to be a follower of Jesus Christ? That's what that whole debate is in Acts chapter 15. And at the end of Acts chapter 15, and Paul and Barnabas are one of the people that are there kind of explaining to the believers there and the leaders there in Jerusalem, this is the gospel we're preaching, this is what we're seeing. And the leaders there of the church in Jerusalem, they said to Paul, you have it. You're teaching the right gospel. And that Gentile people do not have to become Jewish to truly be followers of Jesus Christ. So then they circulate this letter at the end of chapter 15. And Paul then also writes Galatians as kind of a way to explain to the believers in that Galatia area the decision about what has happened in Acts chapter 15. So we'll get to that eventually. But this chapter starts to lay some of that groundwork of what's happening with the gospel spreading to the Gentiles in Acts chapter 10. So you have this guy, and I know we kind of talked about this a little bit a couple weeks ago. In Acts chapter 10, this guy that lives in the place of Caesarea, again, if you look at the map, it's about 30 miles north of Joppa. So Peter's down there in Joppa. This guy named Cornelius is up in Caesarea. Why is he, does anybody remember why he's up there in Caesarea? The importance of Caesarea? Yep, he's part of the head of the military army. And that's Caesarea was kind of the main military place for this area. In fact, Caesarea is an important Roman city where the Roman procurator lived along with his Roman troops. And so when you think of Pilate, Pilate's main home is Caesarea, then he would go down to Jerusalem on occasion, especially for like Passover time. And it was all his entire job was to keep the peace. Now, he did not do that very well. Pilate actually gets kicked out because of some of his cruelty to the Jewish people. But this is that city, that's the main city where the Roman troops live. And so that's why Cornelius is there. And he is a centurion, which means he is a leader of how many men? 100 men, a century. Sometimes when you study the Bible, your words don't really come into play until you actually understand what they mean. And this was one of those light bulb moments that just happened to like 3 weeks ago. I looked up, so I always knew a centurion was a commander. And I looked like, well, how many men are these? And all of a sudden they said 100. I was like, well, that makes sense. Century is 100. Therefore, centurion is 100 men. So I still have those light bulb moments. So a centurion is a commander of 100 men. And centurions were military, lifelong military leaders. This wasn't a political role that played in the government. He was a hardened fighter for the Roman soldiers there, the Roman army. He is part of what cohort? The Italian cohort. And that just means a centurion, a leader of 100 men. A cohort is a person, is a military term that is made up of 60 centuries, which means 600 men. And the Italian cohort was the term, and it probably was meant that all 600 men came from Italy. So they signed up to be, or were told, hey, you're serving in the Roman Empire in their army. And all 600 of these guys were from Italy that are now living in Caesarea to kind of keep that peace there in the nation of Israel. Verse 2, it says that he was a devout man or a godly man, that he also feared God. Somehow, and again, maybe it's just been because of his time there in Caesarea around the time of the nation of Israel there, he hears about Yahweh, he fears Yahweh, and he allows the teachings of the Jewish people to impact his life. That's why a devout man, a godly man, who fears God. It's fascinating is when Jesus, there are times in the Gospels where there was a Roman soldier that came up to, I would think back, was a conversation that John the Baptist had with a Roman soldier. And the Roman soldier said, no, do I have to give up being a Roman soldier in order to be baptized by you? And he's like, no. You know, just be a good Roman soldier. Don't take advantage of your situation. Don't harm people that you shouldn't be harming and so forth, you know. And I think that's kind of this understanding of godly, that he, in a real sense, yes, he was this warrior, part of the Roman army, but he feared God and he was, and he treated people with respect. And you'll see that even here towards the end, that he had a good reputation. Jump down to verse 22. This is his servants describing the Peter who Cornelius is. Cornelius, a centurion, an upright and God-fearing man who is well-spoken by whom? All Jewish nation. So he had this good reputation amongst the Jewish people of being a good person. He gave, jump back up to verse 2. He was who feared God. He gave what to the people? alms. And what are alms? Contributions, charitable giving. He helped people, and he prayed to God continually. So, I mean, you see kind of his heart. Yes, he was still that warrior idea that he led his troops in the battle, but yet he cared for people. And that's why I think that he's described as a godly person who feared God. He understood that Yahweh was the one true God. And so he is there, and he is, what is he doing in verse 3? He's doing what? What does he see in verse 3? He has a vision. And when does this vision take place? 3 in the afternoon, or some translations will say the ninth hour. And again, the significance of that is the time when evening sacrifices are taking place. So we don't know. Maybe he was praying to God during this time, because that was the time that Jewish people would typically set aside to pray as the sacrifices were going on. But he sees this vision. And in this vision, he sees whom? An angel of God. And how does Cornelius, after the angel of God says to him, Cornelius, how does Cornelius respond? What is it, Lord? The same way. It's interesting, because you go back to Acts chapter 9, and when Saul is on the road to Damascus and he sees the vision, and he sees Jesus there, and he says, and Jesus says, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Acts chapter 9, verse 5, Saul responds and says, what? Who are you, Lord? And again, we looked at that. I say, no, that word Lord, some people will look at that and be like, oh, Saul is seeing, he understands who he's talking about. He doesn't. The word Lord probably should be symbolized, who are you, sir? It's the exact same here in as Cornelius sees the angel, and he says, what is it, sir? The angel talks to him and says, you know, God has seen everything that you've done. And he gives them this message to send, to go to send there in verse 5. Now send men to Joppa. Summon whom? Peter. So send men to Joppa. Get Simon Peter. He is lodging with whom? Simon the tanner. I mean, these are very specific directions that this angel of God is giving to Cornelius, to go get Peter. He's in Joppa. He is staying with Simon the tanner, whose house is by what? The sea. So he, verse 7, the angel departs. So what does Cornelius do? He sends two of his servants and a soldier to go get Peter, right? Verse 8, everything related to them. He told them probably, hey, I saw this vision. This angel has told me to do this. And so we see Cornelius here obeying what the angel of God told him to do. So in verse 9, the scene continues. So in verse 9, we now pick it up the next day. So 3 o'clock in the afternoon to now the next day, we have Peter who is going up on the housetop about what time? About noon, or the sixth hour. Again, the Jewish people start their day at 6 o'clock in the morning. That's when these hours come with the Jewish time set. So 6 o'clock to noon would be 6 hours. 6 o'clock to 3, that's why it's called the ninth hour. So Peter goes up on the housetop, and again, or the rooftop, and again, the houses are flat roofs. So this was kind of like they would go up to that top floor. It was almost like a deck that they would go up to, enjoy the nice arid environment. I mean, you look at this modern day picture of Joppa, and you still see like kind of the flat parts of their houses with the windows up there. I mean, that would be where Peter would be up on just up there. Yeah, well, those are old houses, so it's made out of stone. So, yeah, oceanfront view. Yep. So, and who knows? One of them may be Simon the Tanner's house, right by the sea. We just don't. We never know. We don't find walls that say no Peter was here. That would be awesome, but we just don't do that. So, on the sixth hour, Peter goes up, and we are told that he gets hungry. Right. So in verse 10, he becomes hungry, wants something to eat. Again, it's, we would typically think, oh, it's lunchtime. Of course, that's so. That's they're preparing. What does Peter enter into?
Trance.
A trance. And that word trance means is that he enters a state of either a whole or partial unconsciousness. So he sees his vision, and as he sees his vision, He's not aware of anything else that is going on around him. That's what that unconsciousness is referring to. He's not aware of the sounds or anything. It's just all that he sees is his vision from God. And what does his vision look like? A sheet descending with what? With four corners, and what's in the sheet? A lot of animals. So you have... Verse 11, he sees the heavens open, something like a great sheet descending, being let down by its four corners upon the earth. Verse 12, it is in it were all kinds of animals, literally four-footed things. That's literally what the Greek says, which plays into the Old Testament language in Leviticus chapter 11, verse 16, talks about four-footed beings, and so that's again some of this play on is what's going to happen, and we'll see here. So these animals, these reptiles of the earth, birds of the air, and then he hears this voice, and what does the voice tell Peter to do? Kill and eat. So you have this scene of this all these animals within this sheet, and this voice. And we're told later on who this voice is, or is the voice of the Lord, telling Peter to get up and kill and eat. And how does Peter respond? You got it exactly. You got to be joking, right? Verse 14, Peter says, "By no means." That's as emphatic as you can get. In other words, are you out of your mind? For I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean. That's what the different translations may translate these last two words differently. But that word common means this. Means being of little value because it's common. In other words, it's there's a lot of it. The other one is unclean. It has to deal with it being ceremonially unclean or impure. And so as this vision takes place and Peter sees this sheep being let down and all these animals in it, he recognizes them that all these animals are unclean, impure, common, that they're abundant, but none of them follow the Old Testament dietary laws. Which is why Peter says, "Are you out of your mind?" Because Peter is a Jewish guy, right? And Jewish people, good Jewish people, follow the dietary laws in Leviticus chapter 11. You can read that whole entire chapter. But pretty much to sum up what happens in Leviticus chapter 11 is the Lord comes to the nation of Israel and says, these are the animals that you are to eat, and these are the animals that you are not allowed to eat. In fact, if you touch these animals, what happens to you? You'll become ceremonial unclean. Well, some of them you are ceremonial unclean for several days. A lot of them is that you become ceremonial unclean until sundown. And if you become ceremonial unclean, what does that mean? You can't approach particularly the tabernacle or the temple. And again, that's one reason why, as Connie was saying, there are certain animals that Jewish people stayed away from, right? One of them was pigs. They weren't allowed to eat pork. They weren't allowed to eat pigs, which is why when you have Jesus explaining in the prodigal son that the son is working on a pig farm, that culture in that day and age would be like, man, this guy, he's rejected his Judaism. That's how low he's gotten. And then you recognize that he comes to his sense, maybe comes to some of his senses. And when his dad welcomes his back as his son, and just showing that the grace and the mercy and the love that the father has for this lost son of his. And just that kind of, again, that the first century would have thought, you know, this kid has lost everything because of him rejecting, going after, even wanting to eat pig food. So pigs were one of those unclean animals. So you have this scene where Peter sees this, and you have all these animals coming down, and that's why Peter says, no, I'm not eating these because they're unclean. I'm a good Jewish, law-abiding Jewish man who only eats what you have told us we are allowed to eat. Now, here's the question. Why did God give the dietary laws to the Jewish people? Some people say for health reasons. What else? Depending on who you listen to or what you read about the dietary laws, there are some people will point to, well, you know, that the reason why God didn't want, especially when it came to like pork, God didn't want people to eat pork back then was because they would get sick or there would be diseases that were entailed with them. Who knows when it comes to that? Some of it may have been health reasons, but a lot of it was a simple fact of the Lord just saying, you are my people. These are the animals I want you to eat, and these are the animals I don't want you to eat. Walk in obedience to me. Some of it could just simply be, some of it also was the Canaanites' diet, and that distinction that God was trying to give the nation of Israel, that as they entered into the promised land, that they were to live differently. That was one of the biggest things about how you could not boil young animals in like their mother's milk and blood and things like that, and you couldn't eat the blood and so forth, because that was some of the Canaanite practices that they would do. And it was God who was saying, you are my chosen people, and you are going to live differently. And some of them, if you look at, like, just makes sense. I'm not sure why anybody would want to eat crows or insects. I know there are some cultures that will eat cockroaches. Even in America, we were at the zoo. We saw this one scene in their insect building of all these things, packages of insects around the world, like chocolate-covered cockroaches and ants and things like that. I'm not sure if I would be able to do that. So a lot of the dietary, a lot of the Old Testament law was, you are my chosen people, you are to live this way, so that you remember that you are my people. And again, Leviticus chapter 11 explains all that, to be set apart because you are my chosen people. So Peter says, no, I'm not eating these. And then he gets rebuked, right? Verse 15. The voice came to him a second time and says, what? What God has made clean, or what God has made pure, do not call common. Again, that understanding of clean is fascinating. Again, some of these words that Luke uses is this understanding of to purify. This ceremonial cleanliness is what this word comes from. Is that, in other words, what God has made ceremonially clean, has purified through ritual cleansing, don't call common or profane. A lot of, again, as we go through this, and as it particularly relates to the Gentiles, And Peter will get this. Eventually, Peter understands the meaning of this. Not so much right away. But eventually, Peter understands that this is referring to the Gentiles. That God has made Gentiles ceremonially clean, has purified them. How has God purified Gentiles? Through what? By Jesus' death and resurrection. So you have this where as God tells, you know, what God has made clean, what God has purified, do not call common or profane. Well, how many times does this vision take place?
Three
times. And so again, this is a process, okay? So even though I say, no, Peter didn't get this right away, this is a process that, again, you, understanding this mentality shift, because your entire life, and Peter probably, you know, he probably was probably around the age of 30-ish during this time, and his entire life has been told, you do not eat these animals. As a good Jewish person, this is how you are to live. And then the gospel of Jesus Christ totally turns that upside down. Which is why, when he sees this three times, he is perplexed. He's thinking in his mind, well, what does this mean? Why did God give him this vision? And again, at the end of chapter 10, he recognizes how this plays out. But he's confused. He's thinking, he's scratching his head. He's like, God, I don't understand. In the Old Testament, you tell us not to eat these things, and now you're telling me to go and kill and eat this? Like, how does this play out? And then on top of that, I think because of how Peter responds, you see verse 19, that while Peter is pondering this vision, is thinking about this, and is wondering, well, what does this mean? You know, why is God showing him these unclean things and telling him to eat? You know, why? Why does he get rebuked? Because he says, no, I'm a good Jewish person. I'm not supposed to eat that. And then the Spirit of the Lord tells him in verse 19, behold, three men are looking for you. And of course, while this whole time is going on, as Peter is up there on the rooftop, these three guys find Simon, the tanner's house, and is knocking on the door and the gate there, and is looking and asking for Peter. And so the Spirit then tells him, verse 19, these three guys are looking for you. Verse 20, arise, go down, accompanying them. And again, the translation that I'm reading out says, without hesitation. Does anybody have anything else in verse 20 there that says, instead of without hesitation? Did it what? Doubting nothing, for God has sent them. That's probably a better translation than without hesitation. Because literally it says this, that with accompanying them without hesitation is to not differentiate by separation. In other words, don't think, hey, these Gentiles are showing up, they're looking for you. Don't differentiate between them and being like, hey, you know what? I can't associate with you because you're Gentiles. Again, that was the Jewish mentality. I can't have anything to do with you because you're Gentiles. And the Spirit of God says, no. Go down, accompanying them, talk with them, because why? I have sent them. Don't think twice. Again, these are Gentile men showing up at Simon the Tanner's house looking for Peter. Jewish person, Peter would have been like, no. And the Lord is saying, go. I'm sending them to you. Go. As the gospel of Jesus Christ begins to advance into the Gentile, within the Gentiles, don't write them off because they're Gentiles. Just because you've been told for the past 30-some years they're nobody, you know, God still loves them. And God and Jesus purifies them just like he does to the Jews. So, verse 23, end of verse 23, what we read. So after they tell Peter, hey, Cornelius sent us, and who, and that he was given this vision and so forth, how does Peter respond? He invited them in to be his guests. Which again, for the rest of the day, we don't know what time they showed up. We just know the vision was at noon. Probably maybe they showed up at 1 o'clock or so. who knows? But for the rest of that day, these Gentiles were welcome into Simon the Tanner's house, and Peter literally entertained them and had, you know, this conversation with them. And then the next day, he goes with them back to Caesarea. But you begin to see, even within Peter's life, that immediately transformation when the Spirit of the Lord said, "No, I sent them. Don't separate yourself from them." That immediately Peter welcomes them and begins to have this relationship with Gentiles, which is interesting. I know we're running out of time here, but again, this, how important this chapter is, number one. Number two is it puts into light some of the discussion that Peter and Paul had in the first chapter of Galatians, where years later, Peter understands what the gospel of Jesus does. Again, if you want to be Jewish, you want to follow the old dietary laws, then be Jewish. If you want to, but it has nothing to do with your salvation. That's cultural. Just as like in America, there's that, okay, how are we followers of Jesus within our culture? It's the same question that Jewish people have to ask. How are we followers of Jesus within our culture as Jewish people? And it's what we wrestle with in any culture that is. The Old Testament law, the Leviticus 11 comes after, way after. And that's what Paul's argument in Galatians is this. As Abraham was declared righteous by faith first, then God comes to him and gives him circumcision. Then comes the Old Testament law. But faith was first. And that's what Paul's argument is all throughout the book of Galatians. So Galatians 1, 2, and 3 hammer that away. Maybe we'll start there next week. We'll jump to Galatians to kind of look at a few things in Galatians. So, well, that's one of the things you see as you go through the book of Acts is, I mean, the apostles, I mean, they, even though they received the Holy Spirit in Acts chapter 2, I mean, God still took them on this journey. And they, like, God worked in their lives to help them understand that this gospel of Jesus is for everybody. Because of this mindset that was so ingrained, especially when you think of Paul, and I mean, he was trained as a Pharisee. And again, the mindset of we are God's chosen people and you all are sinners. And then he is how his life, his thinking totally changes to the place where then he is going to the Gentiles and telling them about the gospel of Jesus Christ. Just a radical change that takes place within their thinking.